fellow members of the Theosophical Society. Since the Society came into being just over 84 years ago, the world has passed through tremendous changes and upheavals, as we know. And there have been many changes in men's outlook and point of view and ideas, particularly in the West. Despite an underlying conservatism or a plain indifference among many people. In line with these changes, and perhaps even as a contributory cause, the Theosophical Society has passed through different phases, and one or other particular aspect of Theosophy has been stressed at different times. At the same time, there has always been a certain underlying basis or quality from which the significance of our movement has sprung. And it is this which I particularly wish to discuss today. To understand this particular significance and quality, this fundamental idea beneath the platform of our movement, let us turn back the clock to the middle of the last century and see the crisis into which our society was born, for it certainly is a dramatic picture. At that time, so far as most people in the West were concerned, the book of Genesis contained the authorized version of creation, of the earth and of life. In fact, Archbishop of Usher of Ireland had gone so far as to pinpoint the date of creation as Sunday, October the 23rd, 4004 BC. The fact that in the East there existed ancient traditions which had been handed down by the rishis through the Vedas for thousands of years seemed to have been completely ignored. And the people of the East, more or less, were regarded as ignorant heathens who needed to be saved from perdition. There was, however, a new factor being created, beginning to shape itself in the human mind. And this was the slowly awakening realization that the succession of life in the geological record did not correspond to the 6 days of creation as outlined in the Bible, in the book of Genesis. And secondly, that the developing biological knowledge pointed away from the Bible assertion of a separate creation of each species. Then, in 1859, the great English naturalist Charles Darwin sounded the death knell to the old concepts when he published his work, The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. The shock which this theory produced must have been tremendous, you realize what it meant. If all the animals and man had been evolved as Darwin suggested, then there had been no Adam and Eve as our first parents, no Eden, and no fall. And if there had been no fall, the story of the first sin and the reason for atonement were swept away. That is, of course, if the stories were taken literally, as was very much the case. And so theologians fought the new theories bitterly, and a great controversy developed in the Western world, resulting in a growing mutual antagonism between science and religion. Darwin himself wrote, you know, that evolution is quite compatible with the belief in God, and he saw an awe-inspiring grandeur in the evolutionary sweep from so simple beginnings to the endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful. However, this statement seems to have been largely ignored, and there developed the attitude that since Darwin said that all nature is at war and the strongest ultimately must prevail, it was a matter of the struggle for the fittest and survival and each man for himself. And so the moral teaching of religion was discarded. Many lost their faith in a spiritual basis underlying the universe, and a wave of materialism swept the Western world. The effects of this upheaval, of course, are still greatly evident in the world today, though there has been, in recent years a greater growing together of religion and science, as science begins to approach, even though tentatively, metaphysics, and as religion becomes more adaptable to the facts which science discloses. But even as materialism began to take such a hold, there appeared another factor in the form of spiritualism. The belief in spirit manifestations has, of course, existed throughout the ages. But a definite form of spiritualistic inquiry and belief began to take shape in America in 1848 as a result of the phenomena being occurring in the Fox, home of the Fox family. And this led to great excitement and wonder as the possibility of communication with the dead began to be considered. And so the movement spread like wildfire across America and in Europe during the 1850s and 60s. And there was a tremendous outpouring of phenomena drawing attention to the existence of or the possibility of superphysical worlds which could not be explained by the new materialistic science. By early 1875, the interest being displayed by this phenomena was so great that many newspapers were devoting columns and inquiry to it, if you remember, and there was a great deal of interest. Despite this interest, however, and the flood of literature which was appearing, there was no particular organized investigation, and no philosophy about it was emerging. Many malpractices began to creep in, frauds were perpetrated, and communications often did not rise above fortune-telling or licentious doctrine. And so we have two tremendous and powerful influences developing in the growth of human attitudes. On the one hand, the growth of materialistic science with its concomitant godless philosophy, and on the other hand, spiritualism with its phenomena and astounding manifestations, but without an accompanying philosophic system to explain the phenomena in a rational and intelligible manner. Now, it was into this world scene that Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky stepped. A colorful and vibrant personality, as we know, she was herself endowed with remarkable psychic faculty, and she was in touch with Eastern adepts who had trained her in occult knowledge. She believed, and many others shared the belief, that she was their agent for particular work, and that she acted in accordance with instructions which she received from them. HBB, as she was called, thus entered the spiritualistic movement to explain its phenomena, to expose its fraud, to enlarge its spiritual scope, and to present an occult philosophy based on the teachings which she received from the teachers whom she served. But something more was needed, a separate movement. And so HBB's greatest task, on the instruction of her teachers, was to found with Colonel Olcott, who was also in touch with the adept teachers and others, the Theosophical Society, as a channel for the dissemination of spiritual and occult truths, though at the same time allowing complete freedom of thought for all its members. Now, this purpose was made clear right from the beginning, and I feel that this is important for us to hold in mind. We find in the preamble to the first bylaws of our society this statement, that the founders hoped that by going deeper than modern science has hitherto done into the esoteric philosophies of ancient times, they may be enabled to obtain proof of the existence of the unseen universe, the nature of its inhabitants, if such there be, and the laws which govern them and their relation with mankind. And then continued the preamble, stressing this concept of the freedom of thought right from the beginning. Whatever may be the private opinion of its members, the society has no dogmas to enforce, no creeds to disseminate. Its only axiom is the omnipotence of truth. Its only creed, a profession of unqualified devotion to its discovery and propagation. That was an original statement in the preamble to the first bylaws. And then came the great brotherhood idea with these words. In considering the qualifications of applicants for membership, it knows neither race, sex, color, country, nor creed. Now, the concepts laid out in this preamble obviously formed the basis for the three objects in their, which were put into their present form sometime later. And the idea of freedom of thought, though perhaps sometimes overlaid in our earnestness, has been clung to tenaciously throughout the years. Now, I think it's important for us to remember that the brotherhood idea, the first object relating to universal brotherhood, was based not only on an idealistic aim, important, desperately important as that may be, but it was based on a profound philosophical statement found in the early communications issued by the society, that the fellows believe in a great first intelligent cause, and in the divine sonship of the spirit of man, and hence the immortality of the spirit, and in the universal brotherhood of the human race. The years that followed were tremendously important, of course, for the society. But in the development and of the basic literature and teaching which was made available to the world, Madame Blavatsky was being used by her adept teachers for bringing forward a vast and tremendous system of cosmology which showed that the law of evolution, which Darwin was beginning to expound, was part of nature's process, but that it applies not only to the evolution of physical matter which Darwin saw, but to the unfoldment of consciousness within the form, and that life exists on other levels beside the physical, and that there are other streams of evolution besides our own. Not only was the adept teaching coming through Madame Blavatsky, but communications were received, as you know, by Colonel Olcott and others. Particularly amongst these, of course, was A.P. Sinnott, who received a stream of esoteric teaching from the Mahatma Kutumi and also from the Mahatma Maurya. And later these letters were published and have become a priceless source book for students of the ancient wisdom. Then in 1888, as we know, The Secret Doctrine was published. Earlier there had been Isis Unveiled, which had caused a tremendous stir. The Secret Doctrine, as we know, is concerned with the field of cosmogenesis and anthropogenesis. We've heard this several times during our sessions, based upon the stanzas of the archaic manuscript, the Book of Zion, of which it is a commentary and interpretation. Now, Madame Blavatsky made it clear, and this, I think, is the reason why we can definitely state that theosophy is not a new religion, that what she put forward in The Secret Doctrine was not a new revelation, but rather that it was a collection of fragments scattered throughout thousands of volumes, embodying the great scriptures of the great Asiatic and early European religions, hidden under glyph and symbol. The aim, she stated, was to show that nature is not a fortuitous concourse of atoms, and to assign to man his rightful place in the scheme of the universe, to rescue from degradation the archaic truths which are the basis of all religions, to uncover, to some extent, the fundamental unity from which they all spring, and to show that the occult side of nature has never been approached by the science of modern civilization. That was the aim of The Secret Doctrine, and it would seem to me that that aim still stands. Now, in introducing The Secret Doctrine, you'll remember that Madame Blavatsky outlined certain fundamental propositions. These have already been quoted a couple of times in our meetings here. These important propositions which underlie and pervade the whole system of esoteric philosophy. but for the sake of completeness, I would just like briefly to repeat them. Firstly, that there is an omnipresent, eternal, boundless, and immutable principle. This infinite and eternal cause is the rootless root of all that was, is, and ever will be. Secondly, the eternity of the universe in toto as a boundless plane, periodically the playground of numberless universes, incessantly manifesting and disappearing. This assertion is the absolute universality of the law of periodicity of flux and reflux, ebb and flow. And thirdly, the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul, the latter itself being an aspect of the unknown root. And then, of course, this important part that applies to us all, the obligatory pilgrimage for every soul, a spark of the former through the cycle of incarnation or necessity in accordance with cyclic and karmic law. From these three fundamental propositions come the whole vast and complex system of cosmogony, the great story of creation, of periodic activity and rest, the unity of all life, the visible in the visible and in the invisible worlds, and that the concept that man himself is a reflection of the macrocosm is the universe in miniature. It's so tremendous that the mind reels, and yet it is a logical and grand picture that is unrolled before us. Now, for many of us, the two doctrines of reincarnation and karma, which are implied in the propositions, which bring it down to ourselves, have been the aspects which have had the greatest appeal. The popular presentation, giving a sense of justice and hope in life. And in putting forward these twin concepts, the society has done and continues to do a great service, particularly in the West. There is, however, of course, a very much more to be garnered, a rich field of knowledge buried in these priceless works. Not that we are limited to these works, but these are the particular works which it has been the function of our society to present. Not only, of course, is this an intellectual pursuit, but it opens a life in a spiritual sense also. For, as I've already said, the propositions proclaim the fundamental identity of every soul with the oversoul or the divine. And this implies, of course, that each one of us is a pilgrim god, and that our task is to discover and to express the indwelling deity in ever greater fullness. And to help the seeker to find for himself the spiritual path, we have had some exquisite teachings given to us in such works as The Voice of the Silence, Light on the Path, and others. Each one of us, which unfolds layers and depths of meaning, which it seems can never be exhausted. Now, with the passing of Madame Blavatsky in 1891, there ended the first and, of course, the most important phase in the history of our society, for it was then that the foundations were laid to support the whole structure of our movement. In the 16 years, short years, between the formation of the society and her death, HBB presented in the works which I've mentioned and in others, as well as in articles and miscellaneous writings, a vast collection of ancient teachings to the modern world. And it would be correct to say that these, together with the Mahatma letters to A.P. Sinnott, form the bulwark on which all later theosophical literature has been built. And that the fund of knowledge which has been given to the world in these writings is still far from being appreciated. The literature, of course, since then has been greatly expanded and developed by such eminent writers as Annie Besant, C.W. Leadbeater, and others. But the basis remains, as I have suggested. Now, my purpose in going into all this historical detail with regard to the early days is not simply because of its historical interest, fascinating as that may be, but rather to emphasize, firstly, the inner origins of our society and the inspiration which came from the Eastern adepts or teachers to Madame Blavatsky, Colonel Olcott, A.P. Sinnott, and others. And secondly, that the society, though its main platform rests on the concept of brotherhood, and though it has no enclosed body of teaching, was actually started to collect and diffuse knowledge of the laws which govern the universe. And thirdly, that the philosophic system which was expounded in the Secret Doctrine and the Mahatma letters was part of the ancient occult or esoteric tradition. And so the society was no ordinary one. And therefore it was, and it continues to be, I suggest, of deep significance and importance. Despite this, of course, the society from the beginning has stressed the absolute freedom of thought which members share, and the fact that no member is bound either to believe in the existence of the adept teachers, or to accept their teachings which came through them or their pupils. All is offered simply for the consideration of the student and seeker, and each one must find for himself what is his path and what is his way. And if he finds that some other body of knowledge is of value to him, then that is his way. But this is one body of teaching which, of course, is explored in many other fields and in much other literature. I'm not trying to in any way limit it, but this has been a particular function of our movement. That was the note which was struck in the early days, and it is in our hands, I suggest, to ensure that it is sounded today as strongly as ever. Now, just as the society, by its creation, was of tremendous significance in the last century, so I suggest it is of equal significance today, and its message is needed equally today in the great crisis which confronts us. The crisis in every age, of course, must ultimately rest with the individual. But in the mass, it expresses itself in different forms. And because of this, our emphasis changes to meet the needs. And our presentation, our methods, our techniques also must change. We must speak in terms of modern knowledge. All the time, though, our underlying purpose remains the same. Now, as several people have said during these discussions, I think we probably all agree that as we look at the world today, we cannot fail to be struck with the fact that on one side there is the tremendous outpouring of knowledge regarding science and technology, which provide a continuous stream of discoveries and inventions which can be applied to material advancement or destruction. And on the other side, at the same time, as our president, Mr. Sriram, has recently written in his Watchtower notes, there is a marked spiritual decrease, a steep decline in spiritual values and a disbelief in them, which is already yielding its crop of ills, increasing demoralization in social as well as individual living, the falling off in standards, and a leveling down of everything to the lowest common denominator. This demoralization, which seems to be a general tendency of our times, goes hand in hand with the brilliant advances in the scientific field. The mind that is good enough to deal with concrete facts and figures fails somehow to seize the deeper truths that can give us and lead us towards the intangible values. Though man now can conceive of the conquest of space, he cannot for a moment, or at least for most people, begin to tame himself. And so we see the world in the midst of the most thrilling and yet at the same time most terrifying times. Now, as we look at the world today, our movement with the background of world events of the past and the present that I have referred to, we must naturally, if we are earnest members of the society, ask ourselves, what is the meaning and significance of our movement today? The society cannot have passed through many crises, and really good crises, in its history, and continued to carry on through incredible difficulties in various parts of the world without some purpose, carrying on its work. In the early days, of course, much that was discussed from our platform was spectacular. So we got people to come and listen to us because we were different. The ideas such as the extrasensory perception, the study of the Eastern religions, reincarnation and karma, these were exciting themes which were new in the early days. But now, of course, we find them being studied and accepted by many groups. At the same time, at the popular level, we must still provide a platform, even though others may do so, for the discussion of such ideas, for we still have a message for people who are seeking at this level, in showing the application of the great principles of karma and reincarnation, of breaking down intolerance between peoples of different nationalities and religions, and in showing their common unity, and in the effort to promote universal brotherhood through practical and altruistic methods. It is in putting forward such ideas as these to the inquirer that the society can provide the first stepping stone toward deeper truths. It provides a framework for the seeker who can then add new aspects of knowledge as his search increases and has his own inner realization of various truths expands. And yet, of course, there's something very much more than this, as we know. This further development of our work may not have such popular appeal. It seems to be still pioneer work for us to do. That, of course, relates to the intellectual approach to our work and, for want of a better word, to the esoteric facets of theosophical society for which the society can and does provide a unique vehicle. Not the only one, but it was primarily started for this purpose. Now, at the intellectual level, we see a beginning in the work being done in the field of theosophical research, about which we've heard something in the very fine session which was held the other day, particularly in relation to modern science, though, of course, there is still a great deal to be done. This work is just beginning. And as science begins to approach the superphysical, does it not become more and more necessary for us, by a wise presentation, to draw attention to the knowledge available in the secret doctrine, the Mahatma letters, and elsewhere? This, of course, calls for trained workers who are able to present this information in an acceptable and non-dogmatic manner. Only in 1959, in his Reef Lectures, Dr. A.C.B. Lovell, a British radio astronomer, in discussing various theories of creation, said, and I quote, "Any cosmology must eventually move over into metaphysics." Astronomers are now looking forward to the day when they can peer so far into space or back into time that they will be able, they think, to explain what kind of a universe this really is. Now, will the statements of the secret doctrine contribute some useful knowledge in this direction? In space research, as we know, science is delving into new worlds literally and figuratively. There is in occult literature a description of the nature of interplanetary conditions and unseen forces. How will this knowledge affect space flight? And will scientists, even individual ones here and there, draw on this knowledge and attempt to put it to the test, either to confirm it or to deny it through some scientific breakthrough? Statements concerning life on other planets, too, will soon perhaps be tested through man's exploration. in the fields of anthropology and paleontology. We find that the age of man is gradually being pushed further and further back, nearer to the age stated in the occult teachings. These are interesting fields to watch, especially as we find the discovery of ancient skeletons revealing more and more about early man and affect current theories of evolution. Archaeology is another field where occult research can be applied or put to the test, and it is interesting to watch developments now taking place as new discoveries in Jericho, Mexico, the Libyan desert and elsewhere are showing that civilization is much older than was originally believed. Experiments in the field of thought, its influence on living things, on plants, on humans, are taking place now under test conditions. And of course there are various scientific investigations regarding man's extrasensory powers. Now these and other fields of research are of tremendous interest to students of theosophy, and there's much that we can contribute if we can do so in a logical and reasonable manner, and if we really study for ourselves the occult teaching and grasp it as thoroughly as possible so that we are able to relate it intelligently and, as I said, non-dogmatically to modern knowledge. We have, of course, available to draw on the vast system of the secret doctrine based on the three propositions which I have mentioned. The metaphysical philosophy provides a living, vital, yes, and even exciting story of manifestation and man, and makes life so much more worth living, so much more of an adventure for us if we can accept and can understand and grasp something of its wider significance and apply it in our lives. That I feel is important. The other day I got this question about what good is all this talking. It is because we can gain a deeper understanding which can give us a sense of purpose. Passing from the intellectual approach, we come to what I suggest is the most important aspect of all. And this relates to what we might call the spiritual and occult life and mystic experience. The personal discovery and awareness of the individual, which can help him, through his own discovery, to realize some sense of purpose. Now, it's no good discussing all these things intellectually if we cannot ourselves make some of this knowledge our own, not through cliches or repetition of words, but to make it a living experience for us. It is no longer a cliche, for then it has reality for us, and we can communicate something of that reality to others. Obviously, man is not finding security and a solution to the problems of life in external achievements and wonders of modern science. The very helplessness which we must all feel as we see the absolute madness of continued testing of nuclear weapons, with a very real possibility of the pollution of our atmosphere, not only for us but for generations to come, makes us realize that great scientific advancements are not in themselves enough. Of course, one of the most profound human problems of our time is that the human spirit is trying to express itself by words, ideas, and concepts that have become totally inadequate in the modern world. The fanatical adherence, for instance, of man to outer physical and material values, and the narrow prejudices in some countries based on the so-called superiority of color, race, and creed can no longer be maintained, even though men still try to cling to them. It is the neglect by man of the great imponderables within himself, and therefore in others, which is the cause of so much distrust between man and man and nation and nation. Therefore, if we could allow a fuller expression of the spiritual values and ideas which are clamoring for recognition in so many ways, and our actions and reactions would be impelled from a higher or deeper level. Reoriented to a vision from the spirit, there would be a completely new outlook and approach to our personal relationships, which would have an effect in an ever-widening sphere in world attitudes as well. Of course, in the midst of material riches, our civilization seems at present to be spiritually poor. And so we continually search for artificial excitements from without, organized distractions, as Rowett may have called them, amusements, sensations, all the time seeking for security. But it is not without that we need to look for the true values of life. Surely that is evident. And that is, it seems to me, is where the greatest contribution that theosophy has to make is in the present crisis. That, I suggest, is where our work greatly lies. Not that we're just seeking self-development for self-aggrandizement, but that we can become better people in the world and in our relationships with others. This is not something new. It's certainly not exclusively ours, for it has been taught by all the great teachers and enshrined in all the mystery and esoteric traditions. But we can take a lead today, I suggest, through our movement, in reiterating and emphasizing what has been summed up in the ancient Greek axiom, man, know thyself. Man's greatest need today is for self-knowledge and self-understanding, not simply as a way of escape, for it will never be achieved if that is the motive, but in order to glimpse for oneself the light of truth and to bring that into one's life and share it with others. All of us here who are students will know that the basic teaching of occultism is that within each man there is a higher consciousness, active and potent in its own manner and on its own plane, upon which the ordinary personality can fall back, though normally it is unconscious of it. The more we study our own nature, the more it opens out to infinity, and the more we can see the possibility of discovery that the self in man and the self in the universe are one. The hidden depths of our own individual consciousness provide a much bigger challenge for us than the outer depths of space. And it is an exploration that any one of us can embark on at any moment of time. We don't have to wait for our governments to pass laws and to make billions of pounds and dollars available, or to wait for the impetus of fear and war and competition. We can start now if we are really in earnest. And so therefore the great message of theosophy in one of its aspects and one of its most important aspects, as I see it, is the science of man's own inner nature, by which man knows himself, not only by merely his phenomenal form. When a man enters occultism, and that is really what is implied, he takes his own nature and his own destiny into his hands. He commences to do what no one else can do for him, and that is to work out his own salvation. The test which he brings upon the authoritative systems which have been hitherto offered to him as the solution of the problems of his own nature and of the world, with which, and particularly of his own nature, with which he is now face to face, simply can be tested only by his own direct experience. And we must remember that this does not mean simply the conscious experience of his present physical life, but experiences and intuitions welling up from the deep, unfathomable subconscious parts of his own nature, the fruit of many lives, the experiences not only of a particular thread of individual consciousness linked by memory, but also of a larger consciousness on a higher plane, embodying the experiences of individuals, of families, of tribes and races long buried in the oblivion of the past and yet active, living, potent and vital in every cell of our bodies and present with us as faculty, instinctive memory, and whatever measure of understanding we may have. And so we have the psychological and spiritual approach, which means that the mind as well as the body requires to be recreated and regenerated. Even as the atoms of the physical body must be changed and renewed if health is to conquer disease, so must the mental and mind forms in which we have encased ourselves for so long be dissolved in order that they may no longer form a barrier to the recognition and expression of the true self within, which comes from what we might call the transcendental regions of being. And so the personal message for each one, and that to me is the great message of theosophy today in the present crisis, is that our present consciousness is capable of becoming something more than it is at present by falling back upon some more universal mode of being and by bringing through to the physical brain a deeper and wider consciousness which already exists. In all ages, man has been taught, man, that thou art that. We ourselves are the path, and within ourselves, the crisis must be solved. Now, by attempting this, we're not, as some people think, trying to escape from our responsibilities, the realities of life in this physical existence, or from our obligations. Far from it. It is the most practical teaching we can have, for by following this, we can strengthen ourselves for the helping of others. This keynote, of course, has been sounded by all our leaders. It is constantly being repeated by our president, Mr. Sri Ram. He has said, one must seek in the depths of one's consciousness the vitalizing center of one's being. This approach, in the terminology of Krishnaji, means the stripping away from oneself of all one's preconceived ideas, prejudices, and authorities, and discovering, by a process of stilling the mind, that with that self which lies in the unknown part of one's being. And so, each one of us as individuals, I suggest, can make a contribution along these lines. Each one of us has some sense of the mission of our movement, or we would not be here today. We wouldn't have taken the trouble to come all this way to attend this conference. And therefore, we are drawn together in a common search with a common purpose. And I suggest that there is, through our membership, not that we must be members to do this, but through a group membership such as this, and our own individual search and understanding, that we can in some small measure contribute a mite toward the solution of human problems and the understanding according to our own realization and discovery. Again, to quote Mr. Sri Ram, he's recently written, "The individual, even though he may seem lost in the mass, is not insignificant. If he has in him the quality that will act as a leaven to leaven the whole. Organization alone is not enough, however good it may be. Each one of us can be a force in the direction of evolution if we manifest that spirit, which, though little in evidence today, must be the dominant spirit of tomorrow. One swallow cannot make a summer. There has to be first one swallow or a few and then more as summer sets in all its force and glory. We, each one of us, can be one swallow and then one more and one more, each one making a contribution through our movement, which though admittedly a minority movement is spread through more than 60 countries of the world and surely can and will continue to have much greater influence than we may think, judging from the numbers of its membership. This, of course, depends on us, on the life and vitality which we give to the movement. Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, has stated that throughout history there have been minority movements, which, however, have been creative minorities, providing strength and vitality for the spiritual regeneration of humanity. Therefore, our society, though relatively small in numbers, can be a truly creative minority, having much greater effect than we may realize, if we as individual members will keep alive the creative spirit and attitude in our work. The unique function of our society from the very beginning, as I have tried to show, has been to be the custodian of this vast and precious body of esoteric teaching, not exclusively ours, but available for all who are searching for understanding. And as we look without our society and within, I think we can agree that our work is not finished, and that in fact it is as yet hardly begun. There is an unlimited field open for us for research, for study and activity, and for practical application so sorely needed in the world today. And though we sometimes may see ourselves as appearing rather mediocre in some of our lodge meetings, and with so few outstanding personalities, we have in the past been depending so much on great personalities to lead us. The significance of our movement has never been lost and is no less great. We have a treasure house of teaching here in our hands, and through the deeper understanding which we each one of us can unfold from within ourselves, so that our learning becomes not only the doctrine of the I, but also the doctrine of the heart, we can each one become wiser and more useful citizens in our own homes and communities. And thus I suggest our contribution to the climate of world thought and understanding will grow in strength and value, and the society will continue to be an important factor in the world, even though unrecognized by the mass, firmly based as ever on its three objects.